Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talking Logistics, where we have conversations with thought leaders and newsmakers in the supply chain logistics industry. It's my great pleasure to welcome today's program noted author, speaker, and consultant, Carol Sanford. And today we're going to talk about a critical goal for supply chain executives, developing a workforce that cares. This is a topic that, is near and dear to my heart. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of conversation taking place these days about there being a talent shortage in the supply chain logistics industry. Certainly, when I talk to a lot of supply chain logistics professionals, they're working, with their HR teams in terms of recruiting and hiring and training and retention. But one of the things that I hear a lot and really don't have the answers is, how do we develop a workforce that cares? And what does that even mean, right? And why is that important? And that's really going to get to the heart of, the conversation that we're going to have today with Carol. Again, she's an expert in this area, has had the opportunity to work with great leaders at great companies, and we're privileged to have her here on the program to share her insights on this topic. I just want to remind those of you that are joining us live today that part of our goal here at Talking Logistics is to make this conversational. So if you do have a question for Carol as we're having our conversation here, you can do so via the submit a question button or via the chat feature. And certainly if it's a good and appropriate question and we've got time, I'll try to weave it into the conversation. Just a reminder that if you are joining us as a guest or as a visitor, I should say, you do have to register first before you can ask a question. So with that, Carol, welcome to the program.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
Well, Carol, whenever we have a new guest on Talking Logistics, I always like to find out a little bit about their career path and how they got to where they are today. So, before we kind of dive into this topic, why don't you tell us briefly a little bit about your career path and kind of your work today as a consultant and author?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I guess what I would generally classify myself as an applied educator more than a consultant. And what I mean by that is consultants usually have programs. You go in, you give them, here's all the pieces, here's how you do it. I educate people a lot on how people come up with those programs, what it is that's behind them, so that people get smarter about what they're designing for their own group. I do that as a part of helping them do the work as we go. So it's not a classroom kind of thing. It's why I call it applied. How I got into doing that is, one way you could say nobody would ever hire me. That's not quite true, but I started out as a professor, an assistant professor, of course, is where I started. And I was in Silicon Valley. And so I was working with Apple the first 2 years, and many of its engineers who were trying to learn business acumen. I got tapped by Hewlett-Packard's Barney Oliver to come help them look a bit at the challenge they had of an entire, what I call value-adding process, of which supply is a piece of, which went all the way back to R&D going through engineering into manufacturing and into the market. And as a result of that, Barney talked me into leaving. And I wasn't real happy in an educational institution anyway, a little too political for me. I left, he introduced me to a lot of his friends, and I spent, the last 40 years pretty much what I call Carol Sanford Institute, working with organizations to really look at how it is you create a quantum leap growth, like 10x growth. And of course, I work with Google, and so I picked up that term from them and moonshots, which are pretty much what I've always done. Right now, I am moving back toward academia, which makes me laugh. University of Washington has asked me to bring back my 40 years body of work and put it in an academic institution where it has its own integrity. And I'm the new executive director of the Regenerative Business Executive Education Program or Center. And what we're doing there are helping executives, particularly around the Puget Sound, although I've got folks flying in from Mexico. And the second thing is I'm still working transferring a lot of the capability I have through Carol Sanford Institute and doing assessments of companies to help them really understand where they are and the ability to pull all this off. So I just condensed about 50 years into about 2 minutes. It's a great life.
No, that's great. And kind of seeing they all come full circle, right? Starting out as an assistant professor and, building up this great body of work and then being able to come back and share those insights that you've had in terms of working with great companies.
I forgot to mention that all my clients got tired of me sending people to them for references, although they were happy to do that. And they convinced me to write some books, which I've done. Responsible Business, Responsible Entrepreneur, pretty soon The Regenerative Organization, which is a lot about what we're talking about today. all of which are bestsellers and multi-award winning books. And so you can learn a lot more about it if you're curious, picking up any of those books.
No, absolutely. And I was going to make reference to those books, because obviously I think those are all, you know, great resources. You know, you had the, you know, you, last October, you spoke at the Alemica Users Conference. And, you know, I know that prior to the conference, you know, the attendees took a survey, you know, about the challenges that they faced and the skills that they were trying to acquire. And topping the list, you know, were talent development and designing teams for higher motivation and results. I mean, did the survey results kind of surprise you? Or, you know, is this something you're hearing, you know, from other companies across the various industries that you work with?
It did not surprise me. I run that survey everywhere I'm going to speak, because I keep finding, especially as we've come out of this recession, but I would say pretty much for the last 20 years, talent has become a really big question. And part of that is the tech industry. The boom that's happened in the tech industry is sucking out the kind of people who normally love these really complex jobs. The thing that I think gets missed, people say they want a talent. That's the phrase now, right? Let's get a talent. And they forget, I mean, first, that all the research shows us people aren't born as a talent. They don't even get it by experience. And it's not even a set of abilities. It's more a set of critical thinking skills, an ability of how to think about business acumen, about how earnings, margins, and cash flow happen. And the other half is really about personal development. So if you look at what it means to really have talent, it means you develop them, and that you do it in, I guess, what I call pretty much an ongoing way. And I'm not talking about training, because that's knowledge and skills based. Now, you do have to have that. But development really means you grow who I am as a leader, what I can see, and particularly how I can position the work that I'm doing and help connect people to that. So I think that I was just in a great conversation with a young startup in Silicon Valley yesterday that I'm working with. And they said, what we want you to do is advise us on how we hire the right people. And I said, you already got most of them. What you need to do is you need to create something very powerful, and we'll get to that, I think, a little later. But you have to create the right kind of system first to attract people, but more importantly, to grow them. Because we know now, we've done work, we even tracked some of it in DuPont, where we took IQ tests, people agreed to do that, thought that would be fun, and discovered that the average raise over about 3.5 years of a different kind of education and different kind of development move their IQs from 18 to 20% on average. So you can make people smarter. You can make them better decision makers. And I think that's the shift that the 21st century is demanding of us. So anyway, it was not a surprise at all to see that. Pretty much shows up everywhere.
Yeah, no, that's a great point you raised there that I hadn't thought about it. And certainly I think we're going to uncover it a little bit here in our conversation. That is that, you know, the difference between training, which I think is what I hear a lot of folks talk about, right, and development, right? And I think that there is a distinction there, as you just noted. I think we're going to get into that a little bit here in the conversation. And first off, you know, kind of before we talk about, you know, how you go developing a workforce that cares, what does caring even mean in a workplace environment? I think it's important to kind of define that a little bit. So what does it mean?
If you think about your family, you have four children, you said, right, and a wife, you feel a lot of caring for that family. And what it basically means is that you want to know how their lives are working. You want to contribute to the potential they have. And especially as you think about your children out into the world, how is it that the greatest potential and the uniqueness of each of them is really manifest in the world? And you want to be there all the time for them, bringing what you can. That caring comes from immediacy. It comes from direct connection. What I do with corporations, and I encourage them to do just from hearing me, is to shift a bit more away from trying to delegate and give them what they should be doing and connect them. So what I mean by caring is you actually care about the user's experience deeply, not on some customer feedback form. But you want to know how it is that it's affecting their lives. I mean, Google, we have an advantage because most of the people who are designing systems are using them at the same time. So they're a user creator group, but you can create that in any organization. So the caring comes from really being user connected and in an ongoing way to the same people you're producing something for, not by data. It means then designing what you do inside from the outside. So it's like an outside in. You know what's happening with them. You don't spend all of your time designing what you're going to do based on how well it works for you, how you get more efficient. Whatever is not helping the user is inefficient, and you should get rid of that. But what you really want is the effectiveness. So I guess I would define caring pretty much as being so connected to the effects of your user that you know exactly what to do for them on how you work inside. And that's caring, just like it is for your family.
No, that's a great way to kind of view that. You know, as you were talking and kind of defining that, you know, it made me think about the relationship between third-party logistics providers and their customers, you know, that outsourced the logistics operation of third-party logistics providers. And, you know, time and time again, the most successful relationships are those that develop what I would call a shared vision statement with a focus on the end customer, right? So it's not about how the 3PL is going to save money for their customer, meaning the manufacturer, retailers that's you know, outsourcing to them, but it's really about how are we going to make the end customer experience, right? So if it's a retailer that's outsourcing the logistics process, it's about you and me, the consumer, right? How are we going to help the consumer find that product on the shelf more, you know, more frequently or at a better price, so on and so forth. So it's really keeping, I mean, I like that, having that connection, you know, that outside in perspective in terms of building those processes. So I think that, you know, when you were talking about that, I kind of, you know, thought about that.
Let me add something to that, could I?
Absolutely.
I want to take what you said one step further. What I'm talking about actually is one step beyond that. So you're not actually looking at the shelf. You're actually looking at the life of the user. So the work that it becomes really important brings about caring is not knowing whether you got them what you're making and got them the right thing and it works and it's on time and all of that. It's when they can get it more often. It's what happens in their life when they use it. So, for example, in DuPont, when we were working with the Fibers Group, who makes string that goes into airbags, now they don't make the airbags. The converter next to them makes the airbags. And so you could then say, all right, but there are people who, like the automobile makers, who are going to put the airbag into their car. And what really matters ultimately is the automobile maker making the very best car and the very best experience, but also how safe is someone sitting in the front of the car. So we held, and instead of doing a vision statement, we set up teams that are responsible in an ongoing way for knowing how it is that the automobile makers are able to make the lives of the consumer or the automobile, the user, work. And they don't have a vision, because vision to me is too abstract. It's, you know, like becomes too grandiose. They have teams which are committed every day to actually visiting, being in, working on the assembly line, not only with the converters, because they have people there, the automobile makers, but also creating, being a part of the clubs, et cetera, that people create for automobiles. So I think part of what caring is really about is getting further and further and further downstream, which is the same thing you were hinting at. I'm just suggesting there's another level downstream. Plus, we also have to look at the level downstream that has to do with our effects on the ecosystem, on society, because how we run businesses affect all of those. So I think maybe you've given me a better answer to caring. It's like outside in, but it's also getting further and further and further downstream into the lives.
No, that's great. That's great. I mean, I think that's great insight there. And I hadn't thought about that. So I think you've given me some additional food for thought. I think you already answered part of this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think it's on the minds of a lot of folks as well. I mean, if an employee is getting their job done, you know, that is, you know, they're coming into work, they're getting their job done on time, it's good quality, you know, they're completing everything as expected. I mean, why does caring even matter, right? If they're, yeah, you know, kind of getting stuff done on time.
Well, actually, I haven't answered that question. I've hinted at it. So let me talk about that. There are always multiple kinds of work that can go on at the same time. And most of the time, we only require one level. So I'm going to give these a name. You don't have to stay attached to them. But there's like an operate level work where the operations are running. People are doing just what you said, you know, tasks done on time, done well. There is a maintain level of work. And the maintain level is much more about How do we make sure that all the systems we're working with continue to run and are effective? And even the systems that are about distribution and sales and so forth. People don't tend to think about that second of the three levels at all when they're doing a good job. They're doing what they were assigned to do. Delegation works. Job descriptions are clear. And so what you will get is kind of at a current level, people doing what they're told. But I believe that the second level you can get when you get caring is much more this idea of I'm thinking every time I do a changeover, every time I run a machine, how could I be thinking about putting better maintenance, having that machine work better while I'm doing this? And there's a third level, which is innovation and improvement. Because if people are working at the operation level, that's great. I mean, that's a condition of employment to me. It has literally nothing to do with whether or not you're improving a business. And you can pretty easily move a little bit into a step of how you get people to maintain the systems and have it better, have a better relationship with the people who are maintenance people. But this level of how do you innovate every time you run something? I mean, why can't you? I mean, when a craftsperson is making something, every time they make a new, let's say they make leather jackets, they probably raise the cows, slaughter them, have the dyeing vats, tanning and so forth. They would every round be asking, how do I improve based on that, what we just talked about, that downstream ideas coming in? How could I innovate how I'm doing this so I improve not only the quality of what I'm producing and its utility, but also what it can do for the ecosystem, what it can do for the society? So to me, caring is the process of getting all three of those lines of work. And I've done it for 40 years, so nobody can say to me, yeah, but how do you do that? You have to hire the right people. No, you develop the right people. You develop them being able to see those different levels at work at the same time. And now you have a business that can grow and phenomenally, you know, it can grow at scope and scale. It can grow at speed and velocity. It can have flexibility. But you can't have that if people are good people doing their job on time. You will stay at the bottom of the pack. You'll probably stay in business, but it's not enough in the 21st century.
No, great, great point. I think it leads me to my next question. And I just want to quickly say that I see that we've gotten a few questions here, so I will try to weave those into the conversation. So thank you for those of you that are submitted questions. Thank you. Kind of building off of that, it is, not caring, a function of the individual? Is it a function of company culture and their practices and processes? A combination of both? I mean, in other words, kind of what are the main root causes of workforces or individuals that don't care?
Yeah. It's really, well, pops into my head four things right now, not two. The first one, and these have a slight amount of sequence to them, although they're much more organic than sequential. But if you don't have strategies, whether it's at the supply chain level or whether it's the business level, that are compelling, they are demanding, they are exciting, people want to be a part of them, then it's really hard to promote caring because I'm contributing to something I already know. This would be like you with your children saying, well, every day I feed them. You know, every day I make sure they have clothes on their back. I make sure they get to school. But if you don't have some idea that you're starting to help your child and your user and everybody in your company think about what could really happen that's strategically good for the business. You've got kind of a hole in the caring equation. The second thing is, and you mentioned, I think this is true, you do have to have culture. And culture is, now a fancy word people use all the time, and I don't think they actually know what it means. If you think about culture as an anthropologist, which I've worked with before, you're talking about the kind of rituals that make you see the world the way you do. You're talking about what you see as, well, what you give status to, what you see as important, like who you promote when, what you give rewards and recognition to. All of those things designate status. And we try and create rituals in organizations without, like making sure we have an all hands on deck or there's some kind of annual event. Those kinds of things are rituals and they will condition what people are doing. There are also things that are taboo, like you can't go around your boss. You know, those kind of things will weaken a culture of caring because once people care, they want to know and they should be able to call up marketing. They should be able to call up customer product design. And if you can get that kind of culture going, now you have a real chance of promoting much more caring because you're in one that has that as the values which are there. The next thing is capability. I think people forget when they say talent development, you're actually talking about an idea that people aren't fixed, that they can develop, they can grow, they can be smarter, they can have better character, they can be have higher levels of will, they can have stronger and more expressive levels of being, you know, what they really care about and are showing. If you don't have an ongoing process of building capability, you can't elevate what people care about. You can't evolve it except by trying to condition them by demands and by rewards and recognition. The fourth one kind of ties it all together, which is it's the ability to be directly connected in mind and body, you know, knowledge to the user. You have to not have people try and get people excited by data. Data, information, and inspiration only, you know, can go so far. What you want are the what really promotes the an individual and teams caring and doing extraordinary work is that they are directly connected to the effects of their individual choices, their individual work. And it's very possible, and I think we'll get to that. I saw that in your kind of tentative outline. We can get to a bit more of how you do that, but I think it's those four things. I think it's the culture, the capability, the connection directly, and then I got an S in there for strategy. I couldn't think of another C.
No, that's a great you know, framework you provided there in terms of thinking about that. You know, we have a question here that I think kind of relates to what we just talked about here. It's from Sanjay. I'm going to go ahead and put it up on the screen. And, you know, the question is, what is the role of purpose of an organization in the development of a workforce that cares?
All right. So I don't use the idea of purpose very much. And part of it is it's become kind of like mission and vision. It is too abstract. I'm really into the concrete. To me, what really awakens purpose is knowing what the purpose of your users are and seeing yourself as in service of their purpose. I think that we have become, that there was a lot of great work for good reason. The traditional organizations were kind of become heartless, and it's easy, even with good people, to have them not have enough heart in them. So you found people trying to bring back in, how do we put heart in it? And they took ideas that came out of the human potential movement, like purpose and mission and vision, and introduced them into corporations without having them tied to anything that's really about the business. So it becomes much more separate. We have a purpose, we have a mission, we have a vision, but it's very hard to draw a string in a straight line from what those mean down into what I do every day. So for me, that's why I say strategy and strategies that are directly tied. You know, and for me, they have to be big strategies, very, very compelling. You can't grow the business otherwise. And if you don't have that kind of link built, then they become abstractions. And I do a lot of surveys with people, just like the one you talked about. And I ask them what annoys them the most. And they tell me vision statements plastered on a wall, printed on a card, introduced ever so often, like yearly at the annual retreat, purposes which are very, say, I don't even disagree with purposes, people will say. I don't even disagree with the mission. But they have no way that I know what to do about them except feel good that I work for a company that has one. So I say people don't have purposes, systems have purposes, and the things that we're serving in the system. So Sanjay, I hope you don't have to agree with me. At least that's how I would describe it. And I have a little more I see on another question here that I'll think would help with that.
Yeah, great, great questions, Sanjay. You know, I think as you were answering there, I mean, I think, you know, when you look at it from a, you know, logistics standpoint, for example, I mean, you may have someone that is a warehouse worker, right, that spends their day driving a forklift, you know, putting boxes in and out of shelves. You know, you may have someone that's working in transportation, driving a truck or loading trucks and unloading trucks. You know, I think for those, particularly for those that are, I would say, in the front lines of the operation, sometimes, you know, I think those are the folks that might feel the most disconnected, perhaps, from purpose or understanding, well, how is it my activity of putting boxes on the shelf, how is that helping, the number one, the company make money or improve its profits? And number two, to the, you know, well, everything we've talked about in terms of caring about the end customer and improving the lives of the in the work environment, the end customer, I think that making that connection, I think, is, you know, difficult, right?
Yeah, let me talk about a little bit about how you do that, what I mean when I say capability building. I start capability building with helping everyone, including the truck lift driver, the customer service person, the person loading on the dock, helping them understand how earnings, margins, and cash flow get created. People think those are something the accounting chief financial officer deal with, and you know, hopefully my managers know enough that they're supervising and give us guidance in the right way we do the right thing. I want every person in the organization having the mind of a CEO and a CFO. So if you understand how what you're doing today, this minute, affects cash flow, and it does, there are direct frameworks that you can have people learn to assess how the decisions they're making this moment on the line, in the buying, the sourcing, in the storing, you know, how much in time relationships we have with suppliers, you can help them assess what effect that is going to have directly on earnings, margins, and cash flow. You secondly can do a same kind of thing with actually learning to assess and be live in the experience of the user, the customer, the consumer, the converter, you know, depending on back up how upstream you want to go. You can teach them as a part of capability, the business acumen to know how their choices are going to affect downline. If you can do those two things, you can assess the financial effect and you can assess the effect in use. Then what you have are people every day. If you've got the right kind of strategies and the right kind of culture, they will go after those in a really big way. So it's one of the other reasons I'm just not real excited about purpose and missions and visions. They become very self-centered, all about us, you know, how we're doing, aren't we good? Look at us, we have this great mission. They have very little to do with improving the top line, the bottom line of your business or of the customer. So that's my follow-up on that.
Yeah, no, great point. And as you were talking there, kind of it echoed, you know, what I hear a lot from supply chain executives, you know, VPs and above. A lot of times when I ask them about what kind of skills or knowledge or capabilities are you looking for that you feel you're missing to become a more effective leader, by far the number one answer I get from specifically supply chain executives is they want to improve and have the ability to speak the language of the CFO, right? Really understand, as we just talked about, making the connection between what they do and what they're trying to lead their teams to do, making that connection to the items that appear on the P&L and balance sheet of the company. Because a lot of executives, you know, have come up the ranks, you know, in some cases from with an engineering background or from a marketing background, you know, some non-financial, you know, background that they never really had the opportunity or the you know, to really understand, you know, again, the P&L and balance sheet. And I think what you just said there is kind of echoes what I hear from a lot of these executives, and I think it's a step in that direction.
So let me tell you, one of the reasons I agreed to go back into academia, when they asked me at the University of Washington to come, they first just asked me to come bring what I'd put in my first book, The Responsible Business, because they have a responsible management program. And I said, well, I can't do it separately. It really is much more of a whole business. But what I know would be a good program, and this is the condition under which I would come, is if we're working with business unit leaders who have a P&L, or people who are about to become a business unit leader, or business owners like entrepreneurial ones, or who are ready to transition and need to bring people in, and we teach them the whole of how you bring a business. What I'm mostly getting are STEM kind of people, science, technology, engineering, math, and creatives who, like you said, super bright, worthy of promoting, but then what do? I don't have the business acumen to understand all this works. So that's our target market with this new program at the University of Washington at Bothell, is that level of leader. It'll help everyone, but I believe, you know, starting with those folks is the critical place to start.
Yeah, no, great point. So kind of to build on that, I mean, obviously, you've worked, you know, with a lot of executives, a lot of great companies. I mean, you talked about Google. I know you've worked a lot with DuPont as well and others. I mean, how are they developing, you know, workforces that care? And, you know, what can we learn from these companies?
Well, you read a lot about Google, and most of it is by journalists. There's only been one book written really by an insider, and it gives you a better hint. But they already have the 10X idea. Now, I saw another question from Sanjay, which I want to speak to here because it really matters, which is, how in the world can you have 10x growth with a regenerative business and anything else stay healthy? I think we have very incomplete ideas about what growth means. Because we have had traditional businesses who it meant scale, make it bigger, do more, then that's our only image of growth. But if we still did that after we were 15 or 16, maybe 20 years old, we would explode. So there are other kinds of growth. And the second kind of growth is extension growth, not expansion growth. It's more how it is that I extend what I already know into new places. And so there's not an ongoing more and more of the same thing for the same kind of people. It is we transfer how long the shelf life can be or what it is that can happen with the same products, with the same amount of material so that you don't have resources that are extracted from scaling. But the third one, and the one I'm really advocating, is what you would call evolution growth, which is the kind where you use less resources every time you make it. You use more and more creativity and innovation so that things produce a better and better effect, but you are not expanding what you do in the world, because the question is correct. You wouldn't have a 10X healthy. Now, coming back and saying, what do these companies do? All of them have the kind of growth I'm talking about, which is 10X in evolutionary and innovation, in that we leapfrog and we stop doing so much else of what we do that would be scaling and unhealthy. They do ongoing human development, but it's always tied. And I can't tell you how important this one thing I'm going to say is. You get nothing else out of today. They don't do any training or development independent of having it tied to a 10X strategy. So when you walk into the room to be doing development, to be learning earnings margin and cash flow, you have a specific, not project, because then that goes away, but you have a specific challenge in terms of something you want to create. So when I'll take another manufacturing example, Kingsford Charcoal, which also owns Hidden Valley Ranch, which is the one I want to talk about. When Will Lynn, who is the general manager, said, all right, I want to grow all my people. And I said, okay, what is it that you want to do that's impossible without them being smarter and requiring all of them? And he said, well, I want to take this Hidden Valley Ranch we just bought, this little local thing. I want to take it national. Usually it takes about 5 years to do that. Lucky if you get it in three. I want to do it in 8 to 10 months. I want to have ownership of first, second, and third place in market share and actually in margins while we're at it. And I'd like to have a pipeline that can take something to market every time it's created in 6 months and build out the kind of thing we know we'd be working on for at least a decade. Now, that's a 10X kind of return. There were also some that he built later, which had to do with the experience people would have. But that was not a bad start, just in a supply system. Once we had done that, we went to work, and their job every time they came in was to apply all the development work, all the learning, all the new frameworks, all the business acumen to pulling that off. We got it so that we had about a 12-year pipeline of products that Hidden Valley drew on for years. We could go to market every time precisely with very little shortfall, which, by the way, is usually 80% when people try an innovation in a product. We were closer to getting it 90% right instead of 80% wrong. And that was because people were growing. People were learning. They were being challenged. They were reflecting. They were building the business acumen. So that's the first thing they do. The second thing is they don't build teams as strongly. Now, they do meet, but not around the job or the machine, but they build them around external markets. So they will have, like in Colgate, what we did in Europe, we built them around all the particular markets. So you had the mom and pop stores, you had the Carrefour, the big box stores like Walmart here, and a few others, which you had everybody who was internal connected to one of those teams, and they were champions as a team for that particular market. So you have people coming back in connected to the mom and pop little stores in the corner of the Champs-Élysées in Paris. And they would be saying, here's the problem they're having where they are. We're about to be building some new kinds of things. Let's take care of them and how we do this. We've got some ideas have to do with inventory. They were bringing in the people who knew how to help them manage inventory better. You couldn't talk those mom and pop stores out of not buying Colgate products because they were helping them with their business. And I'm not talking about these were marketing people. I'm talking about operating people. We have people who were on the line, who ran toothpaste lines, deodorant lines, who were part of these teams who were out there. They brought that caring back in. And I guess the third thing I would say is this examining and evolving a culture that can support what I'm talking about. Because if you have managers who don't see it this way and don't see themselves as resources rather than bosses, you will slowly, you will just never build the momentum. So the companies that I can tell you about all are doing a version of this, their own way, different kinds of teams, but they're building capability tied to strategy. They're building teams that are tied to markets, and they're building culture that's tied to really how it is you want a system to live. I think that's probably, there are many more we could go on. I wrote books about this, right? And I write blogs and I do podcasts that tell all these stories where you can learn more. And by the way, I don't believe in best practices, but we'll get back to that some other time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think those are all great, you know, insights and, advice, you know, if you will, from what you're seeing and what other companies are doing. You know, Ed asked the question here, I'm going to put up on the screen, which kind of relates to what was going to be my next question anyway. What are some anticipated challenges one might face when endeavoring to pursue a development program like this? And my question was going to be, you know, what common mistakes do the companies make, you know, along this journey?
Yeah, I said when I usually go talk to a company, I never go to sell because, I don't know what percentage, but it's not over 50%, have what it takes to pull this off. So the biggest mistake, the biggest one, and the thing that, I really advise people to do is learn to assess what's right for you. Learn to really think about, I had a guy yesterday tell me, you know, we're so innovative, we'll try anything. And I thought, then you're not very innovative because that's unfocused, scattered. The major thing that is a mistake for people is they either tend to reject any kind of new idea or they tend to take it on whole hog. They don't have discernment about how these programs are designed, how what they're going to produce. I would never agree to hire anyone if I were in a position of anyone in one of these supply chain companies that couldn't explain to me where they got the ideas, and I don't mean like other people in existence right now. I mean theory-based, what's the philosophical base, what's the paradigm it's based on, is it based on machine theory, humans as machines, is it based on them as rats in a lab? You know, if you manage rats, then all of that behavioral theory is great. If you don't, it's not. So they don't know how to assess, and they'll buy programs, not results. Now, you can get any consultant to sell you a program and prove to you results with a few things, but you have to use your own judgment about whether those are even the right results. And I guess the second thing I would say that is an error for people in making decisions about taking on what I'm talking about or anything else is they're way too dependent on consultant programs. Like it comes in a package and you don't start with figuring out, wait a minute, what are you trying to do with your business strategically? What's the essence and the uniqueness of this business? We can see a lot of things that it could competitively go after, but is there really the nature of anything people are going to offer you really going to fit who you are? And that's why I say I'm not a consultant because I don't have a program to sell you. I have a process that can help you learn how to select programs. It can help you grow your own. And then the third thing here is people are too dependent on best practices, which is pretty much similar to being dependent on consultants, where you go get something and you think you can modify it. But if you start from where they were and you try and modify it to you, you will lose who you are because you will be taking things that most of them are never tested by any research or even by assessment. And I even go in behind a lot of programs that have been done, everything from Lean to Six Sigma. And the minute the consultants are gone, even though you put belt colors in place, you don't necessarily grow them toward the strategy. So I think this dependency on best practices, on prepackaged programs, rather than starting from where the business is, doing an assessment of where your culture is, where your strategy is probably one of the biggest challenges that they have. And then the last one is you have to believe, if you want to do what I'm talking about, you have to believe that people are not fixed. Carol Dweck wrote a great book called Mindset, which helped people differentiate. And I'd been saying this for years, and she gave me even some better language and certainly a lot of research, that people are dynamic and growable. And we know that now is true even into elderhood. If You think that people, you've got A players and you've got B players, and you have to get rid of some of your B players and get some more A players. You can't do what I just talked about because you think that people are something, not that they are growing and evolving through a lifetime, and that if you have the courage, you will have people that are 100 times better, and I'm not exaggerating, 100 times better than you could hire. And you will have so much loyalty inside and so much commitment because those people know where it is that their product goes, where their services go, the effect they have. And you will have people who aren't looking for their next job in the next company to leapfrog. They want to be there because you're doing exciting things. So that went on longer than I meant, but I get kind of excited about this part about how people end up borrowing and buying instead of building what they need to be building.
No, Ed. Again, thank you for the great question. I think you provided some great insights there. Certainly, as a consultant and an analyst myself, I always have to take a step back sometimes when we talk about, because it's very common to talk about best practices, right? And kind of really understanding that the dangers of labeling things as best practice or just blindly embracing them, if you will. And what that can, the path that that can lead you down, or I think even more critically to your point, the constraint that that could put on you, because it might limit some creativity that might be, waiting to be unlocked within your organization. The other thing you said that I think sparked my mind was, and I forget who wrote the book, but the idea was, the difference between, well, do you go after, high potential employees or superstars, or do you try to develop high potential teams and organizations, right? And the danger with the high potential individual is that they could always leave the company, and then all of a sudden, there's no foundation left to, move productively forward from there. Whereas if you build a high productive or high potential team or a strong organization, you're always going to have people coming in and out, but you're still going to be able to move forward with, the processes and the vision and the the programs that you've set in place to achieve what you want to achieve. So, your quick thoughts on high potential employees and
Yeah.
individuals versus high potential developing high potential teams.
So I think you should be hiring high potential people, but that's because I think all people are high potential. I believe that what you're building is high potential individuals, high potential teams, and high potential organizations. So I work more with individuals in this deeply because there's something I haven't talked about because it's a little complex to explain is in after people become a part of these teams that are external in the market, they each make something called a promise beyond ableness to that user or customer. They may or may not directly tell them, but more than 50% of the time they do. They have to grow themselves to be able to deliver something, and then they go organize a team. They have to sell it like to a venture capital group, and sometimes it takes 2 to 3 years to do this. This all started in a Procter and Gamble redesign years ago by my mentor, who was there in the 60s doing this. But the idea that you trade off and work only with teams would mean that you're teaching everybody the same. The most important thing is individuals have a uniqueness and a distinctiveness and an essence. They have a personality, but they have something that is unique to them. That ability to bring forward that and have people make an individual, unique, and valuable contribution as a part of a team doing its distinctive work in service of that which is outside is what I'm talking about. So it's not the trade-off of high potential individual. You will get much more high potential individuals. And one of the things that happened in Kingsford is that we got so many high potential people, many of whom didn't have high school educations, who became leaders. Some went out into leading business units of Fortune 500 companies. Part of that happened because the guy who had been leading it left, and the guy who came in behind it, and this is always a risk, decided he did not want this system with all of these people individually generating ideas, even in the context of the strategy. He wanted it functionally divided. People can never not work this way again. You can never not have your potential expressed creative. You can never not make a difference again. The level of caring becomes so high, and a business who can just make this the way they do business hangs on to all of those people. The risk is if you promote someone and you give status to people who focus only on their version of cash flow, margins, and earnings, and it's not the same as mine, because I teach people something very different about how you create cash flow, margins, and earnings. But if you don't get it as a cultural thing, then, you know, it's really, really hard to have each individual and the teams become really high potential.
Great, great, great points. You know, we're kind of running short on time here. I do want to squeeze in, before I ask my last question, I do want to squeeze in a question from one of our participants here from Austin. So let me go ahead and put this up on the screen. And let me go ahead and read it. How do I best identify people throughout my organization so that we can mutually support each other and help drive this type of change in the company?
I'm not sure I understand the question. How do you identify people throughout? And if you're talking about managers, I mean, to me, you don't have to identify them. Everyone can do what I'm talking about. If you're asking about who kickstarts it, I have found that it is hard to do from the bottom up, but you don't have to go to the top. In most cases, the reason I bring business unit leaders into my process is they can see the financial return from it as well as the human development outcome. So probably what I would do is find a series of, and there always are in every company, not everybody is like this, but there are always business unit leaders who have some fiduciary responsibility who will want the kind of change, they just don't know it exists. I can't believe how often I talk with people who say, I've never heard of this kind of work. And I get some of the pieces you're talking about, not even all of them, but I never get it so it's all together. And they've been looking and waiting, just like probably the person who's asking this question. I would find people who had some P&L responsibility. I would get them connected and excited about the idea. But then I would create an educational path, because this isn't about doing. It's more about educating. And so there isn't a program in it that you go implement. So I would find people who particularly are interested in growing, learning, educating. They believe that people can grow, learn, and change. And if I were an internal person and didn't know who those were, I might even be writing white papers or blogs and spreading them around. Some people have on an intranet still have blog postings by folks. I would generate conversations, which were maybe brown bag conversations over lunch or book clubs. I have a lot of people who use my books because they have workbooks that can go with them that are about beginning to have the conversation. So you invite people into the group. And as a result of those invitations, the people who show up are the people who are very likely going to help you. The books give you a way to have a conversation. And now you've launched an education path, which can allow you to build more. I do come and do assessments to help people learn a bit more about where they are as a part of the process and how they could either launch themselves or we could help them launch what they're doing. But I think there are some education pieces as well as just identifying who the right people are.
Great, great point. Austin, thank you for your great question. So, just in the time we have left here, I guess I'll just go right to my last question, Carol, as a way to wrap up. I mean, what questions should supply chain executives ask themselves, to assess if they need to improve, the caring level of their team? And what actions can they take today to begin that journey?
Yeah, so I want to do one last little piece here on the term supply chain. I write a lot about this in my book. That term was formed after a group of Harvard professors, knowing nothing about how Procter & Gamble worked, went in and watched them, and they kept talking about this thing called the value-adding process. The value-adding process with earth to earth, which made the supply system a part of the ongoing connection to how people work out into, as we've been looking at, the consumer, converter, customer, user. And because these professors, I don't know whether they just couldn't understand the idea of a whole, but they decided to break it up into supply chain and value chain. And because they were at Harvard and they wrote books about it, it got to be popular. And they claimed that's what P&G was doing, the most studied system in the world at that time. And unfortunately, the thing that I recommend people do here at the end of our call is you get over thinking of supply chain as something separate and treating it as something separate, and begin to really see it in this value-adding process we've been talking about in this whole call, where you build your business model so that they fall value. The value, it's not value added, it's value adding. so that you're constantly adding value to the user, and the ability for that to happen comes from adding value to the customer. That comes from adding value to the consumer, to the converter. So all the way along, and it comes from adding value to those that source, including adding value to Earth, adding value to the, you know, the those that work with bringing resources from Earth and from ideas. So I think that to get started, I mean, I would actually suggest you go read The Responsible Business, because it'll give you some more of these. It'll give you, it's full of 15 stories of people who've done this. DuPont is one of them. Chad Holliday, the chairman, CEO, and president of DuPont, wrote the foreword. And Rebecca Henderson wrote the academic foreword. She's at Harvard Business School, who said this is the business of the future. If you kind of want to know more, you can start to read and connect in a deeper way that way. I also would love to come if you want, or we could start with a phone call. And you can find me at Carol at carolsanfordinstitute.com. And my website's carolsanfordinstitute.com. You can find more materials there. I do lots of podcasts. As I said earlier, I do blogs. I've got another book that'll be out very shortly, and another one even before the end of the year. I would love to help do an assessment of where you are. And then you can either take it and run with what we do, or we could look at, is there a way to integrate what we could support you doing? Because again, we don't have a program. What Carol Sanford Institute is makes you smarter about how you run a business overall and take your powerful skills forward.
Great, great. You know, Carol, as I always say at the end of our programs, you know, we always manage just to scratch the surface of the topics that we talk about. But we certainly, I think, you know, address a lot of great, you know, topics within the larger umbrella here. So I want to, you know, thank you for your time. And I want to thank Alemica for you know, making this possible as well, for you know, pointing us in your direction and having you, you know, come on it as a guest. So again, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Well, thank you for asking me, and thanks to Alemica. This is great fun. It's obviously, you can tell, a conversation I love to have. And I look forward to anyone who'd like to follow up, checking out the website and just letting me know if any of that feels useful to you. If not, I wish you great good luck in what it is that you're doing.
Great. I want to thank all of you who joined us live today, and including those that asked some great questions and participated in the conversation. If you are watching this episode on demand, and you do have a follow-up question for Carol, you can ask, you can submit a question via the website. So if you go to talkinglogistics.com to find this episode, and you can post a question or comment there, and I'm sure that, you know, Carol would be more than happy to respond via that medium. Of course, she mentioned her website. You can go directly to her website as well. We'll have the links to her website and other ways you can contact her, including links to her book. So again, thank you all for joining us today, and look forward to seeing you in a future episode of Talking Logistics. Have a great day.